Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer and novelist Allison Lurie. Lurie is the author of 10 novels, including The War Between the Tates and Foreign Affairs, for which she won the 1985 Pulitzer Prize. She has also published two studies, The Language of Clothes and The Language of Houses, as well as essays on children's literature. Her new book is called Reading for Fun, in which she discusses some of the most original American and British writers of the last 100 years, and it was published by Cuga Lake Books. And welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Glad to have you back. Now, in your introduction, I found this really interesting. You talk about how there are people who believe there are two kinds of fiction, important literary stories and unserious fiction, fun but not good for the intellect. Tell us about that.
Well, unfortunately, this is an idea that I think some people get from their high school and college courses. There are things you have to read, and somehow you feel that they're not going to be fun. They're going to be work. And then there's the things you read to yourself. Now, sometimes by accident, you'll find out that they overlap. But it's not very common. And I feel this is a terrible mistake. I think that really good books are fun to read. Mm. And if a book is not fun to read, it may be the author isn't really trying to communicate or isn't trying to communicate to you. He or she may have a different audience in mind.
That's really it. So did you evolve this thought process, or did you learn this too, that serious novels are the things you should concentrate on and the rest of it's like junk food for the soul?
Well, it's interesting. When I was in college, literature stopped with Virginia Woolf for women. Oh. And she was in the textbook. And past her, there was nobody. Yeats was in the textbook, and past him there was nobody. And then I remember that there was a guy in the class with me who, he'd gone to the library. Somebody found out that there were poets called Auden and Dylan Thomas, and he'd taken these books out, and he was passing them around, and it was as if they were the chocolate bars, and T.S. Eliot was work. Ah. And at the moment, of course, if you start on Proof Rock and The Wasteland, it's heavy, it's serious. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, you have Dylan Thomas and Wales and all the excitement and the love of nature, and it's a completely different feeling. And we felt as if these were our writers, and the other writers were what we've been told we had to like, you know. Although, of course, now I would say they're all good. But at the time, there was a cutoff, and people who were alive were somewhat under suspicion.
God, isn't that sad? Oh, that's
it is
that
sad.
That is
of course,
so sad.
It's different now.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, of course. Now, some of these essays in this new book were published in magazines and all over the place. Well, what is it that makes you want to write an essay about a writer? I'm sure you read constantly, but I'm sure you don't write about every writer
that
you read.
Oh, no. I mean,
what draws you to the writing
really
about it?
If I really like a book, I want to write about it. And sometimes I'll look around and see if I can find some way of doing this. Some of these articles were introductions to reprints. For instance, the first one, Henry James's The Bostonians, there was a reissue of that book, and I wrote the introduction for it. And similarly with Lolly Willows. And I actually had asked if I could do that, you know, when I... And sometimes people would say, is there something you want to write about? And I usually have a list.
Mm-hmm. Of writers. Oh, wow. That is so interesting that you want to draw out more than what you've read to discuss the writer and the work.
Yes. Well, I very soon I evolved a rule that I would never write a review of a book I really hated.
Mm.
Because I feel, first of all, you're causing pain and suffering to someone, and you're taking up space in a newspaper or a magazine that could be devoted to someone who's really good that people haven't heard about.
Uh-huh.
So although occasionally a book would be overpraised in my view, and I'd feel an impulse to say something mean about it, but I would resist because it's wasteful and harmful. It
yeah.
doesn't doesn't do anyone any good.
Yeah, yeah, and I know, and it can destroy people's lives. That's what I think, and stifle creativity.
The famous instances of it, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about some of the writers that are in the book. I was really interested in your discussion of Doris Lessing.
Oh, yeah.
One of my favorites. And a lot of people think of her as a feminist, but she really never identified as a feminist.
No, she didn't. She was very stubborn. She didn't want to be typed. She sometimes, I'm afraid, typed herself as when she decided to become interested in Sufism. And this was very puzzling to her friends. And then she went through a science fiction phrase, which not all of her readers could follow her to. I was very disappointed by the science fiction books. I wanted her to write about her real life, which she did so well.
Yeah. Mm. Well, a lot of people identify her with the Golden Notebook, and that's why they thought she was a feminist, right?
Yeah.
Because it's kind of women-directed.
I
read it many years ago.
Yeah. I think she was a feminist, but she wouldn't admit it. I don't know what it was. Maybe she was annoyed by some of the feminists she met. I think she certainly was read by a lot of women whose lives changed because of her.
Mm. Oh, yeah. I've met many women, especially in the, 20, 30 years ago.
That's right, when there weren't people writing like that.
Yeah. You focus in this essay on the Summer Before the Dark, Lessing's, and one of the science fiction stories. And it's really interesting because you say that she sort of concludes that women can't get out of their box that society puts them in, and it kind of disappointed you the way she ended this book.
Yes, I think she did. In that book, she did. I think she was wrong, and I think she saw it later, but she became quite a pessimist in her old age. She didn't expect much of the world, of life. She had this very difficult son who is one of the forces behind the girl and the good terrorist. I mean, someone who believes things you don't believe, and yet you just can't change their mind. It's a little bit like some Muslim parents today must feel when their sons or daughters become radicalized.
Mm-hmm.
You love them, but they believe something that you think is really horrible.
Yeah.
And she had that experience with one of her children.
Yeah, and the pessimism at the end of the Summer Before the Dark, it almost feels like that's the way she felt her life was. That's why she didn't identify as a feminist.
Yeah.
Like no way this is going to change the world.
She became discouraged. But I think she also had moments when she was full of energy and enthusiasm and hope that things could get better,
Yeah, yeah. And she was certainly a good writer. I count her as one of the best writers.
I loved the Golden Notebook. I thought, it was a little bit hard to, it's hard for me now to remember the four different voices. I should go back to it, really, and see how it seems today.
Yeah, I loved it, too. I remember loving it. I found it sort of difficult at the time. I probably read it when I was in my early 20s, so it was more difficult. Now, I want to talk to you about this, too, because you've known a lot of these writers, like Garrison Keillor, and you met Faye Weldon, and we'll talk more about them. But do you think that changes you as somebody who would be writing about someone, if you know them?
I think it makes a difference. I met Doris Lessing several times.
Mm.
She was a great friend of Margaret Drabble, who was an old friend of mine, and she was kind of a mentor to Maggie. And so I went, Maggie took me to her house, and we had lunch. And she was, at that point, she wasn't so down. She was a little sad, but she didn't seem as angry as she became later.
Mm.
And she was living in a rather beautiful ground floor flat on the canal with a wonderful garden, and I thought that she seemed to be enjoying her life really at that moment. But later on, I think things went wrong.
Yeah, I mean, that happens with a lot of writers. The stereotype is you can't be a good writer unless you have a really horrible life. Remember when people used to?
I don't believe that at all.
I don't believe it either.
I feel it's easy to think of writers who had wonderful lives and still wrote well.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Let's talk about Faye Weldon. She's one of my favorites, and I did meet her in San Francisco. She's an interesting character. She was such a character.
Oh, yes, and she was. She wouldn't do anything that anybody expected her to do or wanted her to do. She was very strong-willed, and I remember meeting her in Australia at a writers' festival in which there were lots of well-behaved writers, English and American and Australian and European. We were all got up very proper, and she came in. She dyed a big streak of her hair bright purple, and she was wearing a flowered dress, which she was kind of falling out of. And all the men, just their eyes went, wow. And she didn't care. She didn't want to look proper. She didn't want to look like a writer whose head was full of great thoughts. She was having a very good time. She wanted a drink. She wanted to go dancing. She was like that.
Yeah. And she comes from a rags-to-riches story, too, right? I mean, she grew up really poor. And
that's right.
And she even got people putting her down when she finally married somebody and became kind of a rich woman,
yeah,
living a rich life. People thought she was losing her authenticity, right?
Oh, no. I don't think she did at all. I mean, she got in a lot of trouble for taking money to write a book in which the jeweler, Bulgari, would be mentioned. And people thought this was just absolutely terrible.
I remember
this. Well, I wouldn't have done it. You wouldn't have done it. But she had a good time, and she had a contract. I think she had to mention them 20 times, and she mentioned them 50 times. I forget the number. But of course, people couldn't help but saying, Bulgari, you know.
Yeah.
And she didn't care what people thought. But I think in a way she minded that people didn't take her seriously because she was this kind of woman in public.
Yeah, yeah. She was a woman before her time. Product placement is everywhere now.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
Well,
and women are dyeing their hair with purple streaks all over
yeah.
the place now.
If she'd been born 20 years later, she would have had no trouble at all. Or perhaps if she'd been born in America or even Australia. But there's something about the British literary world at that time that you were supposed to be quiet and discreet and serious.
And proper.
And proper.
And proper. Mm-hmm. What's one of your favorite Faye Weldon books?
Gee, I kind of like the one about the witches. What is that?
Oh, yeah. I can't remember the name of it either. That's funny.
It was a sort of revenge novel.
Yeah.
About the man that her husband left her for.
And I can't remember the. They made it into a film, right?
They made it into
yeah.
a film, and eventually one of us will think of it, and we can go back and tuck its name in. Puffball.
Oh, okay.
That's what it is, I think.
But I think they renamed it for the film or something.
We better check. But she's a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah, she really was. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alison Lurie. We're talking about her new book called Reading for Fun, in which she has published some of her essays that were in literary magazines and newspapers about some of her favorite writers and books. Let's talk about Garrison Keillor. You know him, too.
Well, I sort of know him. I interviewed him. I wrote a profile of him, and I went to the New Yorker and interviewed him there. And then I would see him from time to time at the American Academy, which he was a member of, and he remembered that he'd met me. He was interesting. He was very much like the person he is on the radio. He had that wonderful radio voice.
Mm-hmm.
That was his natural voice. And he had what people used to call a radio face. In other words, he was not a good-looking man.
Mm.
He looked a little bit like a frog, in fact. That wasn't...
I always thought he looked a little bit like a troll or something, something out
troll,
of a fairy tale.
Yeah,
or,
yeah. Very tall for a troll, though.
Yes, yeah.
But, you know, once you got talking with him, you forgot all about that because he was so much fun and had so many good ideas and just made you laugh all the time. But I think that he really what he did for the radio and what he did for America was remarkable, that he invented this town, Lake Wobegon.
Oh, yeah.
Very clever. It has, even the title has so many meanings. I mean, it's a place that's Wobegon, that's sad, but it also means woe, be gone,
yeah.
Be gone, woe. And you could read it either way. I mean, it's as a place where people are sad, but it's also a place where people are very happy.
Yeah, yeah. He really captured people's imaginations with that town. People believed it was real. You know, I know people who still talk about it.
Yeah.
Even though it's been off the air for a while.
I know, but the book is very good. The first Lake Wobegon book is wonderful.
Uh-huh.
Has
uh-huh.
some of the best programs in it. The famous one where the preacher and his wife finally go on a holiday, and they're in some resort town, and they're supposed to be enjoying themselves, but they're not really enjoying themselves.
Uh-huh.
because they miss their hometown and they miss their family and their friends. And after a few days, who wants another shrimp cocktail, you know?
Exactly.
Charming.
You know, you describe Garrison Keillor as kind of a throwback, too, because he hated TV. He was totally into radio. He's totally into reading. It is like an old-fashioned man from the 18th century in some ways.
People compared him to Will Rogers, who used to...
And Mark Twain, too.
And Mark Twain. And I've seen videos of Will Rogers. He used to do a monologue while twirling his lasso, and he talked a lot like Garrison Keillor, this down-home voice, these anecdotes of crazy people who lived in his town. I think he must have picked up something from that.
Yeah. Let's talk about Alice Munro. I mean, one of the most famous short story writers in the world. And it's funny that you talk about the American stereotype of a Canadian writer, you know, that it's, you know, bunch of trees and mounted, you know, but her Canada is something different than that. It's real people and struggling people in a lot of ways.
That's true. It's not pine trees and horses and pioneers. It's people trying to make a living in small towns. It's interesting that where she grew up is not all that far from where Joyce Carol Oates grew up, the other side of the border.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same world in a way. Joyce Carol Oates grew up on a mink farm. It was that at one point. I think her father tried many different kinds of farming that didn't work out.
Uh-huh.
And it's this hard scrabble, not backwards, but the kind of forgotten rural areas that you actually have here around Ithaca. You drive 20 miles in any direction from Ithaca, and you're in that kind of world.
Yeah, and so she writes about real people's lives, and they are real people. It's not just fiction. I mean, to me, her stories seem so real. And Joyce Carol Oates has gone off into different directions. She's like getting underneath the cracks and finding all this evil this craziness.
Her view of the world is much, much darker, and she enjoys terror and fear and violence in a way that Alice Munro doesn't.
You know? Mm-hmm.
I remember the first time I met Joyce Carol Oates was in London, and we were at a party at the house of friends who lived under the path of the planes took to land at Heathrow.
Oh.
And every 5 minutes or so, you'd hear a plane going over. And they'd learn just to stop talking for a minute or 30 seconds. And into this silence, Joyce said, you know, I wonder what would happen if the cargo door on one of those planes opened and a dog fell out.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, because people had been talking, apparently, I hadn't been in that conversation, but apparently they'd been talking about taking animals on planes and how if your dog was too big, you had to put him in the cargo hold. And she said, and then it would fall into the garden. And she looked over the window into the garden, as if she could actually see this dog fall in from the plane into the back garden.
I wouldn't be surprised if that didn't end up in one of her novels. I haven't read all of them since she writes about six a year.
It's possible. But I thought, funny. Wow. What a strange thing to think of.
Yeah.
But that's the way her mind works.
Yeah, we saw her in San Francisco at the Herbst Theater, and she was giving a talk. Her droll sense of humor is what got me.
Yeah.
I think she'd be a great teacher.
Yes, I think.
You know,
there was
something about her intelligence and her...
People who know Princeton said she's very, very popular with the students, and she's done a lot for some of them, found them publishers and helped them along.
She's
a generous person.
Yeah. So. Now, you said something about Alice Munro's daughter, that her daughter sometimes felt like she was living inside an Alice Munro novel.
Yes.
Tell us about that. Did you actually interview her?
No, she wrote about it, her daughter. She wrote an article or an essay, I forget where it was, about what it was like, you know. Or perhaps she was interviewed, I don't remember. But that's what she said, that the world that her mother wrote about was so close to reality that sometimes she couldn't tell the difference.
How strange that must be for a kid. Disorienting.
Well, yes, of course. Then as you get older, she said, then you had your own world, you know, and you were able to separate it.
Yeah. You know, it's hard to sort of think of Alice Munro as a Canadian writer, because I actually think of Margaret Atwood as a quintessential Canadian writer as well.
She's written more about different parts of Canada. She's written about being out in the woods with her family because her father was a biologist, I think, and they used to spend every summer in the woods while he classified bugs or trees, whatever it was he did. And she's written about living in Toronto. She's written about the literary world, the theatrical world, and it's a much wider Canada that she writes about.
Oh, yeah. She's interested in all kinds of... She's having to write about The Handmaid's Tale, since it's, you know, been made into a film.
I haven't seen it, but people say the new version is very impressive. And
yeah,
very good.
And I've heard that it's so dark people are afraid to look at it because it's too much like what might be happening in this country right now.
Yes, well, it'll take a different... it'll be different here if it did happen. It won't be women, you know. It'll be people of different religions. You know?
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I want to ask you this, too. As somebody, a novelist yourself, is it hard for you to read novels just as a reader? Are you always deconstructing?
No.
You are able to read for pleasure.
I'm not a professional critic. I've never written a book about literature. It's very easy.
You've written a book about children's literature, though.
Yes.
Yeah.
A bunch of essays.
Essays. Yeah.
Yes. Even with children's books, when I'm reading them, I forget to have ideas about them. I just sort of jump into the story, I'm afraid.
I have talked to some writers who say, I can see where they're going with this. I can see how this novel was constructed. You know what I mean?
And
it gets rid of some of the pleasures of it.
If I think about it, I can. But I don't really want to, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I did just read Ian McEwan's book, Nutshell.
Oh, yeah.
Which is... It's all the narrator is the unborn child of Hamlet's father and mother, and he observes the affair between his mother and the evil brother. And as I was reading it, I thought of something that he should have done, you know, because I felt he didn't motivate the brother's wish to kill Hamlet's father. Because there was nothing much he got out of it.
Oh.
But I thought, what he should have done, he should have made the guy who's killed a member of the aristocracy so that the brother would want to inherit the title. And I thought, if only I'd seen this before it went to print, I could have told him that he should do this. And but usually it doesn't work like that.
No, I'm
thought,
sure
now,
it doesn't.
I even thought, now, should I try to get in touch with him and tell him that when the paperback comes out? I thought, no, he wouldn't like that.
No, but, and it's a popular book as is. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a very nice man. But this would have been a better motivation.
So you are, Alison Lurie, the writer, is coming up with new
sometimes,
plot twists and
sometimes,
stuff.
Sometimes, but
interesting.
On the other hand, the books that I'm so completely into that I would never think of changing it because I've gone into that world. I mean, and with others of Ian McEwan's books, I've just gone into it and I didn't think that way.
Yeah.
It depends on how deeply you believe the world that's been created for you.
Yeah. Well, are you working on anything right now? And are
not
we gonna
really.
Expect
what
anything?
I'm mostly doing is trying to make a companion volume to this, which will be called Writing for Fun, and it'll be all the best articles that aren't on books that I've ever written. But you know, articles about fashion, articles about people I've known. You know.
Oh, articles. I think that would be fascinating. People.
Oh yeah,
you've known.
It'll be fun. I mean, some of these are more fun than the. Than the literary ones because they're more different, and I've written, for instance, I once spent time with a production of Hamlet again, that was directed by Jonathan Miller, and I happened to know him, and I knew a couple of the people who were in the play. It was in a small theater outside of London, and I went to the original meetings where he talked to the cast. And I interviewed all the people and I watched the rehearsals, and it was so much fun to see what happened and how it developed. And some of them didn't want to say a line way he wanted them to say it, and others fell in love with each other. It was
theaters. It's a whole
theater
little
is like that.
It's a little city unto itself.
Yeah, have you been an actor?
Oh yeah, I've done theater.
Well, then you know what it's
bit.
Like.
Oh, it is. It turns into a little world, and you get so emotional.
I know
and
it.
And so intense about it. Yeah,
I know it. And I've known people whose partners became felt lonely and jealous because for a few weeks or a few months, depending on the success of the play, they weren't part of the family, you know.
Yeah,
the family
yeah.
was the world of the theater. It's interesting.
Well, I look forward to you publishing this book with all your memoirs and people you've met. It sounds very interesting to me.
Thank you.
Alison, we are almost out of time. Do you have a website or any place where people can get in touch with you?
I do have a website. I don't do much about it. Of course, I'm afraid to now that, you know, people are glomming on to anything you have and infecting it.
But your website is alisonlurie.com?
I think so. If you write, you just type it in.
If you Google Alison Lurie,
you
will
get
find
it. It tells about what my books are and how to get them.
And you can also go to the Cuga Lake Books website because they have stuff about the writers they
published. Oh, do they? I didn't know that. That's good.
Yeah. So, Alison Lurie, thank you for joining us. Again, I've been talking to Alison Lurie, the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer. She has a new book out called Reading for Fun, and it was published by Cuga Lake Books. Google them. Google her. Get in touch. Wonderful body of work. Thank you, Alison. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.